chapter 46, verses 3 through 5, in the New Century Version, sort of at the core of what we're looking at today, it says this: Family of Jacob, listen to me. All you people of Israel who are still alive, listen. I've carried you since you were born. I have taken care of you from your birth. Even when you are old, I will be the same. Even when your hair has turned gray, I will take care of you. I made you, and I will take care of you. I will carry you and save you. Can you compare me to anyone? No one is equal to me or like me. It's interesting in this chapter that we're studying here this morning that there are two action words that we come across. And they're actually both repeated, but those two words are this: listen and remember, which happens to be the title of our message here this morning. But these two words are very important. Last week in chapter 45, we looked at that phrase, to look to God, look. And here today we see this, these two words, listen and remember. You know, it's also important to note that the act of remembering in ancient Israel was a major aspect of worship. Part of their time of worship was remembering what the Lord had done. A lot of their festivals, holidays, revolved around remembering what the Lord had done. But I think it's interesting because in order for us to remember, we have to first listen. So listening and remembering go hand in hand. Pause for a second as we're starting off this study. As I was a new Christian, I think I was only about 3 or 4 months old in the Lord. I was blessed with being able to go to a local church in Austin called Great Hills Baptist Church. I didn't attend this church, but I had a friend that was there. And I had another couple friends of mine that went with me to hear a man named Josh McDowell speak. Most of you have heard of Josh McDowell, famous apologist. He wrote the book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And other books over the years, More Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and so on. But that day, I will never forget, or that night, I should say, because when Josh McDowell was sharing his message, he made an illustration. And it was something that really stuck with me as a new Christian. And it was this. He, you know, had us all kind of imagine for a second that there was this large ladder, and of course at the top of the ladder was God, and he was sort of looking down, and there was this maze, and there were all these twists and turns in this maze, you know, and I think he even envisioned there being like one of those rat mazes, you know, where the rats sort of go around and try to figure out where they're supposed to go, and they're trying to smell for the cheese and find the right direction. And, you know, he kind of jokingly talked about how that's how the Lord sees things. Far above our horizontal perspective, God can see all of the twists and turns throughout our lives. If we live to be 80 to 100 years old, that's a lot of twists and turns in the span of just one person's lifetime. And it was something that really stuck with me because of God being above and knowing all of the twists and turns. And Josh made it the point to say that we don't know what's around the corner, but God does. So how much more is it important to look to him to take the right corner, to take the right turn or the left turn? And I always thought, well, that really makes sense. And I was so glad I heard that, because in my early days as a believer, I had a lot of choices to make, things that I needed to decide with God about life, about direction, and I'm glad that the Lord helped me navigate. And of course, it's true for all of us that walk with the Lord. He's wanting to help us navigate through life. But see, God can spot and navigate every turn in our lives. But not only that, also the lives of all people ever. And that goes way beyond our ability to even comprehend. But today, Isaiah 46 challenges us to those two verbs that I mentioned earlier, to listen and remember. And in this chapter, the Lord challenges the people to listen and remember who he is and how he is supreme and far above all of these fake gods that were out there. And really, this chapter is a contrast. It's a comparison between the false gods and the true God and how they can't even, well, God's not even in, they're not even the same category as the true God. In this contrast, there are two greatly contrasted things here, and it's pretty simple. And it's kind of a play on words, but what we see is the hollow gods of the Babylonians in verses 1 through 7, and the hallowed God of the Hebrews in verses 8 through 13. And it's a comparison between the two. But within this chapter, we're going to see one of the greatest, I think, communications about God being outside of time and understanding all the twists and turns, and we'll talk about here about that this morning. But the book of Isaiah has been quite a journey, and as we got to the second part of the book of Isaiah in chapter 40, we came to God's redemptive work, his desiring to restore and help the people to think ahead to the time when he would continue to bless them as a nation. They had suffered because of disobedience and allowing idolatry into their lives. And now, as a result of breaking the covenant that Moses had laid out through the Ten Commandments and the other commandments, they were going to be taken captive soon after Isaiah to a place called Babylon. And God spoke to them long before that captivity took place to the southern kingdom of Judah to say, look, you're going to go and be held captive, but one day I'm going to raise someone up to bring you back. And so really far out, God said, this is the way it's going to go down. And it happened exactly like God said. Now, again, I've said this in the past, but I want to remind you guys, since we're studying here again in Isaiah, read 2 Kings 15 through 21 and 2 Chronicles 26 through 33. Understand the history behind everything that has led up to this book. Isaiah prophesied for 58 years under the last king Hezekiah. He prophesied these things. And as we came to this section, which started really in chapter 44, God spoke through Isaiah that all the objects of worship that were out there other than him were all nothing compared to him. They were all just worthless. And that theme is sort of woven throughout the next four or five chapters. Chapter 45, God was highlighting his unparalleled abilities, his power. But in chapter 46, it's really about the idols of Babylon. Of course, as we come to chapter 47, it's about the destruction of Babylon. But idolatry and destruction kind of go hand in hand. And in essence, to say chapter 46 and 47 sort of go hand in hand. Because in chapter 46, as we learn about these idols of Babylon, it just shows through this communication that man can turn just about anything into an idol and really take things outside or even that are a part of God's creation and turn them into something they're not meant to be. Babylon was the most idolatrous city and empire, and God was going to use this kingdom to discipline the people of God. But at one point, he was going to bring them down through King Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire. So God carries us is this idea that I read in verses 3 through 5. You know, the false gods had to be carried around, but God says, hey, I'm carrying you. And that's kind of at the heart of what we're looking at today, because God is saying through Isaiah, look, listen, remember that I love you, I care for you, I want to hold you up, and that no one else can help. God carries us, but false gods and idols and things that we give our hearts to, they can't really help us. They can distract us. Sometimes they can keep us from thinking about things, but they ultimately betray us. And it's only the Lord that really can hold us up. And so first, Isaiah points to the hollow gods of the Babylonians. I'm going to read through these sections as we move through it, but I want you to think about that idea of something that's hollow. Empty, it's useless, it's meaningless. False gods truly are fake and phony. And just as a side note, as we think about back to where there were these created little gold statues or silver statues that pictured a god that someone would venerate and worship, there are things in our modern culture that are bowed down to, that are bright and shiny, that people pour their hearts out to. And, you know, that we've all seen people that worship their vehicle, you know, don't touch my car. They park way out at the end of the parking lot, because if you were to ding it, it would be a terrible, terrible thing. I remember as a kid when, you know, probably in the mid-90s, when Air Jordans were really, really super expensive. Now a lot of shoes are sort of even more expensive than that, but I remember this one guy, he worshipped his Air Jordans, and I was getting on the bus. One of the last times I rode the bus before I got a life and got a license and drove myself to school. I remember stepping on his Air Jordans and he just, rah! And I said, well, don't you have Scotch Guard on them? And he's like, yeah, but you left a mark on them, you know? And I thought, wow, why are you so uptight about your shoes? I mean, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of having shoes? It's kind of like low riders in a town that has no flat streets, you know? AKA Killeen. Anyways, there's all kinds of gods out there. You know, the psalmist understood this. He said in Psalm 96, verse 5, for all the gods of the peoples are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Psalm 97, verse 7 says, let all be put to shame who serve carved images, who boast of idols. Worship him, that is, worship the true God. All you gods, the psalmist says. Psalm 135, verse 15 says, the idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. So first, Isaiah shows us the hollow gods of Babylon. And look with me there in your Bibles, at verses 1 and 2, there in the 46th chapter. And it tells us, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops, their idols were on the beasts and on the cattle. Your carriages were heavily loaded, a burden to the weary beast. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but have themselves gone into captivity. Pay attention there to the two names, Bel and Nebo. These were the names of two false gods in this idol-worshipping nation of Babylon. And the people of Babylon served these gods. And now it's as if God has been talking about idolatry, but through Isaiah, now he starts to name names. And he gets real specific. These two names would have been the most common, most understood when it comes to false gods and idols. But these two false gods, we're going to be brought low, is sort of the gist of what is being said here. Now, the names of the pagan gods, Bel and Nebo, they should actually sort of stand out to us because of the book of Daniel that Pastor Rod is teaching through and that we'll go through. Maybe you've read it when you hear Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar was, of course, Daniel's pagan name. We never called Daniel Belshazzar, but we call Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Daniel's name was Belshazzar, that Bel being at the beginning and Nebuchadnezzar having the Neb at the beginning. And so these are very common names because of common false gods. And the truth was, these Babylonian gods would not be able to save Babylon from being conquered by Cyrus in the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, it's important for us to understand, as Isaiah is speaking and naming names, naming the two major gods, that Bel was another name for Marduk and the god of the sun. It was the chief god of the city of Babylon. That's important to know. And then Nebo was the son of Marduk, or the son of Bel. And it's interesting because that particular god was the god of learning, writing, and astronomy. This false god was known as the speaker. He was sort of seen as the patron of wisdom, the art of writing. This function, believe it or not, was to sort of communicate with the priests that they had to write on these tablets of destiny, the fates that would happen in the next year. Large images of those gods would be carried around and sort of celebrated on the Babylonian New Year in their festival. And these statues, these gods, were very heavy, very burdensome to carry around. And every year at this festival, they would carry them around the city to a great shrine. And of course, when Isaiah is saying this to the people of the southern kingdom of Judah, because nations like Israel had working relationships with the Babylonians and knew of them, they had what some would call diplomatic contact, they would have known about these festivals. At least some of those who were eventually taken captive to Babylon would actually see these New Year's festivals and this pagan worship right up close. They would witness it firsthand. But these false gods had to be carried around. And here in Isaiah's inspired vision, this festival is sort of seen in its true light. Bel and Nebo had to be carried around, and they were so heavy it wore out the beasts that were carrying them. They staggered, they fell. Instead of a procession to glory, they were in the process of falling down or being destroyed, being doomed. It's kind of the thought. We left off last week in chapter 45 with it's telling us, God speaking, saying, every knee will bow and every tongue will take an oath. And now here he pictures the gods of the Babylonians stooping low in a place of humiliation. Now it's interesting because there's a couple different views of the end of verse 1 here. And if you pay attention to that verse, your carriages will be heavily loaded, a burden to the weary beast. They have themselves gone into captivity there at the end of verse 2. Some believe that Isaiah is picturing here God's people going into captivity into Babylon. Because remember, the people of the southern kingdom were worshiping false gods in their closets and then going out in public and putting on these huge displays of outward Hebrew worship. So there are some that see these idols being loaded onto beasts and carriages as those folks carrying their idols to Babylon. Even their idols got carried away into captivity. It didn't deliver them. They didn't deliver them. They actually went into captivity with them, which shows how useless they were. But Isaiah could also be speaking of the Babylonians. And God's, of course, overtaken them by King Cyrus, and they were fleeing Babylon to escape captivity when Cyrus comes into being the king later on down the road. And so either way you look at it, whether you see this as possibly the Hebrews when they went into Babylon, or the Babylonians when they were fleeing from Cyrus who was coming into reign later on, either way you look at it, these false gods are hollow and of no help. So you could have both of those views, but if you keep the main thing, they were useless. They were the gods of the Babylonians. But in verses 3 through 5, it's sort of like Isaiah flips a switch here, and now he talks about how the hollow gods of Babylon, they can't compare. I want you guys to hear what this sounds like in the New King James verses 3 through 5, and notice what God says. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel who have been upheld by me from birth, who have been carried from the womb even into your old age, I am he. And even to gray hairs I will carry you. I have made you, and I will bear, even I will carry and will deliver you. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we should be alike? See, God's challenge to his people is to listen to him, and it's actually something that he frequently says throughout this second part of the book of Isaiah, chapter 44, 46, 47, 48, 51, 52, 55, he says this over and over. Listen. Pay attention. What does he say here in these verses? Well, besides caring for and also carrying his people, God sustains his people throughout their lives. From the time of conception, according to verse 3, to old age, the Lord is watching over his people. I love this. God watches out for us as his people from our youngest days to our oldest days. He's always watching out. These false gods, really represented by these dumb dead idols, they had to be carried, but God says, hey, I carry you. These idols have to be carried, but I carry you. And I don't just carry you once, I carry you through your whole life, and I'll never let you down. He carried them from their birth, and he promises here to continue to carry them, even to when they get gray hair. It's been noted that, and I've even seen this reference many times, that this idea of God carrying us is something that Jesus sort of talked about. Luke chapter 12, it says this, Luke chapter 12, verses 6 and 7, are not five sparrows, Jesus said, sold for two copper coins? And not one of them is forgotten before God. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, Jesus says, you are of more value than the sparrows. Fatherly care, God's care for his people. When we understand that God has created us, he's made us, and that we are valuable to him, then we can actually lean on the fact that he wants to carry us as his creation. It's great to be in the hands of the Lord, to be carried by the Lord. But it brings to mind that very important question that we all have to ask ourselves. Do we have to carry our God, or does God carry us? You know, there are many people today that have to sort of prep themselves to believe what they believe, and I don't think Christians are like that. I think as followers of Christ, we have God's Word, we have the ministry of the Holy Spirit, we have these testimonies in our lives to see what God has done. We have so many reasons to continue to walk with the Lord. These gods of gold and silver, they can't even compare to this great God who does so much behind the scenes. But these fake gods, they had to hire craftsmen and people that could work with all of these precious metals. They had to be formed and fashioned and put into a place that was level enough where it wouldn't fall over. But they couldn't be moved on by themselves. They couldn't get up and walk away. They had to be carried by people. And this, again, this language that's used is one of the ways that Isaiah is really poking at idol worship. It's belittling those who believe in statues, carved images, false ideas of who God is. Unlike these false gods, the true God can really answer prayer. He can really move mountains and do great things in a person's life. Of course, all throughout human history, people have turned God into something that they thought was cool or fun or exciting. You've got the Greek gods. You've got all kinds of gods out there that have been sort of created by man. But people will make gods out of what they think is fun or exciting. And that sort of translates, because if your God is pleasure, you're going to be burdened by lust. If your God is money, you're going to be in bondage to greed. If your God is intellect or the accumulation of knowledge, then you're going to be weighed down and blinded by pride. How comforting it is to know that God cares for us, even before we're born, but when we're born, and as we get old, he wants to carry us throughout our lives. each moment in between, he carries us. Listen to the psalmist's choice words. In Psalm 139, verses 13 through 17, listen to what the psalmist says. He says, "For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed. And in your book, they all were written. The days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How great the sum of them." A great passage. But this is definitely the idea behind what Isaiah is telling them. Look, God is saying, hey, I'm carrying you people. And these gods can't compare, but Isaiah also shows us that these hollow gods of the Babylonians cannot answer. In verses 6 and 7, he makes it a point. He goes on in verse 6, notice what it says. He says, "They lavish gold out of the bag and weigh silver on the scales. They hire a goldsmith, and he makes it a god. They prostrate themselves. Yes, they worship. They bear it on the shoulder. They carry it. They set it in its place. And it stands from its place. It shall not move." But here's the verse I want you to pay attention to at the end of verse 7. "Though one cries out to it, yet it cannot answer nor save him out of his trouble." The claim of the Bible, God says there is nobody else who can answer your prayers but me. And he's given us every reason to trust what he said. That's a pretty wild claim if there wasn't proof to back it up. If there weren't lives that had been changed and miracles that God had wrought, things that God had done to show that he's there. See, Isaiah is telling us here that much money, much resources and attention are given to the production and the care of all of these idols. They have to be polished even after they're set up. Yet everyone that cries out to them is disappointed. And Isaiah is exposing the folly, the foolishness of idolatry. The gods of the Babylonians, these false gods of the world, they can't do anything for anyone. You know, many times it's actually real life challenges that actually show what a person really believes in. I would say that just if I were to, you know, think about the whole of society, that for the most part, people, majority of people actually worship self, worship their ability to handle things on their own, apart from a divine creator or divine intervention. And you watch this happen when hard things come. You see the fear, the anxiety that people have because they're looking at themselves as the source of protection rather than the Lord. And time and time again, all of us can have seen this, even in the scriptures. Those that knew the Lord well were those that had confidence, not because they had capability, but because they knew the God who did. Man, this season we're in as a nation with this COVID-19 and watching people, and it really brings to the surface what you really believe. Do you really believe in God? Or is it just religion? Sometimes it's good for God to shake up a society because it causes them to actually go, do I really believe what I say I'm going to believe, or what I proclaim to believe? See, God's challenge here is to listen and learn. He is incomparable to all these dumb idols, way beyond what man can make himself. And the irony is that God is real, and they are not. Those things that are right in front of people, some will say this, they'll say, well, I can only believe in what I see. I love how Jesus told Thomas, "Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe." Because the evidence for our Creator is there. But isn't it ironic that people would give up the invisible God, who's real, to have a fake God who's right there in front of their face? Listen to how hollow the objects of worship really are, is what Isaiah is communicating. God is the only one that deserves to be worshipped, deserves to be adored. And so he says, listen, these are the hollow gods of the Babylonians. They're not comparable to me. They're worthless. They won't answer. But I will. And I have. And I will carry you. What an encouraging thing. But secondly, Isaiah leads us to the hallowed. And this is what we find in verses 8 through 13. Hallowed means consecrated. It means revered. See, the psalmist understood that the Lord, the God of the Bible, is worthy to be praised. As you can tell with all my psalm references the past several weeks, I'm a big fan of the Psalms. But in Psalm 4, verse 8, it says, "I will both lie down in peace and sleep, for you alone," the psalmist says, "O Lord, make me dwell in safety." Psalm 83, verse 18, he said, "That they may know that you, whose name alone is the Lord, are the Most High over all the earth." Psalm 86, verse 10, the psalmist says, "For you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God." But Psalm 18, verse 3 is really the one I wanted to really get you to think about. The psalmist says, "I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and so shall I be saved from my enemies." That phrase, "who is worthy to be praised." God is the only one who should be hallowed, who should be consecrated, revered, because he's the only one that's holy. He's the only one that's set apart. He's the only one that's proved himself through telling us the future, telling us history in advance, changing people's lives, intervening, working. Verses 8 through 10, we see God's timeless perspective. And I've really been excited about getting to this section. And I want you to pay attention to what it tells us in verses 8 through 10. Verse 8 says, "Remember this and show yourselves, men. Recall to mind, O you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." We gain a lot of encouragement, a lot of courage, when we remember the things that God tells us to remember. So we start off in verse 8, and God says to Isaiah, "Remember this. Recall this to mind, you sinners." Strong words. Remember this. What does that refer to? Well, if we follow the line of thought, it's referring to verse 7's ending, "Though they cry out to it, it cannot save, it cannot answer." Remember that those gods are fake that can't help you. Remember that I can help you, that I can carry you. Isaiah is telling the people to be courageous, to be reasonable, to be realistic, and trust the true God. As we move into this section, Isaiah is trying to be very practical with the people, because as we study this out, I want to sort of get your attention for a second. Remember, there was a lot of unbelief among the people. I mean, obviously, they had split loyalties. There was idolatry that was going on in the southern kingdom. There was a religious mindset rather than a relational connection to the Lord. there was a lot of people that knew all of the right answers but didn't necessarily have the right heart. There was a lot of disconnect from the truth. And Isaiah is, well, he's trying to deal with a lot of the unbelief and disbelief that the people had. Because some of the folks even looked at the things Isaiah was saying, most likely with skepticism. Cyrus, who's that? The Babylonians being conquered, they're not even on the radar yet. And in verses 8 and 9, the Lord calls them to consider the history of all the relationship that he's had with them. And what this shows us is something very interesting, because as you get into verse 9, remember the former things of old, for I'm God and there is no other. Hey, remember all this stuff I've done? Remember all the ways I've showed myself faithful? That's what God's saying. And this illustrates a very important fact, that faith for the follower of the Lord has an objective reference because it's a response to God's revealed revelation. He said this was going to happen, and it happened. See, as believers, we don't have faith in a vacuum. We have faith based on God's word that has always been true and has proven itself. And so Isaiah is being very practical, but God is speaking through Isaiah. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, there's no other. I'm God, there's none like me. God's past prophecies, his past interventions, his past interactions with the people should have helped them to steer straight in navigating their lives. It could be put this way: God's past involvement should give us present hope. God's past interventions and involvement in our lives should cause us to have something tried and true to look towards, the Lord. In Christ, we know that the Lord's counsel is always true. He has a purpose, he has a plan. I like to think about it this way. His counsel always is going to steer us straight. And God is saying to Isaiah, look, remember the former things of old. But then he says something very important in verse 10. There's none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done. You know, it's been said by one author, he said, time is not God's master. Time is his servant. See, God knows the end of everything, every matter, every course, every direction, every circumstance. Just as clearly as the beginning, he knows the end. And he tells us things that are going to happen in the future way before they happen. This is his claim. Some have called it the fingerprints of God within his word. I think that's a good way to think about it. You know, we have a limited understanding of the past. And even our assessment of the present is fuzzy. I think as you get older, you realize your assessment of the present isn't exactly what you thought it was. I don't know if that's true for everybody. It's definitely been true in my life. When I was younger, I thought, I got a pretty good handle on it. They got older, I don't know what's going on. I think I got a little bit over here, but I don't really know the whole picture. So our assessment of the present is fuzzy, but the future is vastly unknown to us. But God knows the past perfectly, the present perfectly, and the future perfectly in every aspect. And it goes beyond what we can really even comprehend. God knows the end from the beginning because he's much more than some just passerby in the ways of men. He's actually directing things. His works, his plans, they never fail. And that's why it says his counsel shall stand. He will do all his pleasure. And this is where the free will of man and the sovereignty of God come into play. How do they work together? We don't know. But God is able to take things that man does in his own sinfulness that are meant for wrong, and God can actually use them for good. Someone once said that God isn't watching the entire parade of human history. He's directing the parade. And he sees every part of human history. I like to think about this verse 10 as God seeing time from its beginning to its end, knowing everything that happens in between, and having the ability to see the rippling effect that one event in the past has upon the future. Of course, we can't even understand what it's like to be outside of time. But this is God's vantage point. It is his timeless perspective. So think about that. Do I have a timeless perspective? Absolutely not. All of us as people are so limited in what we can see. And to go back to Josh's illustration, we're rats in a maze. They don't know if the piece of cheese is to the left or to the right. But God knows. He can see all of the twists and turns. You just have to follow him. Listen to him. Trust him. The important point that I want to make here is that God's people have to remember this very important information about him. That he knows the end from the beginning. Nothing surprises God. God will never be surprised. He already knows what's going to happen, or it wouldn't be God. Basically, God is telling us here, he knows what's going to happen before it happens, and he tells us in advance. Now, there are a couple of things about God knowing everything that's going to happen that we need to think about. Number one, if you're taking notes, just sort of write this down and remember, it shows how he is transcendent of our experience in time. He transcends it. He's so beyond our very little tiny perspective that for us to even question him is foolish. We don't even understand anything. Now, our hearts will do that sometimes. And the Lord has a way of dealing with us and loving on us and showing us, hey, look, I got it under control. Don't worry. That's the first thing. He transcends our experience, this verse 10. But it also shows the way his word is true. Because if he transcends time and he tells us things in the past that are going to happen in the future, then those things, if they don't happen, would disprove that God is who he says he is, but they have not been disproved. They've only been proven. Now here's the third thing that interests me the most, and this is what I've been dying to talk about, is because God is outside of time, the third thing about this is it shows how he orchestrates our lives. And this is an amazing thing to me. He prepares us for what's ahead, even though we have no idea. Now, I could probably give you 30 examples of this, but I tried to just come up with two good ones. Two that really pop out of my mind as to ways that God, knowing the future, has orchestrated my life and prepared me in the past for something in the future. And one of the ones that really stands out to me is the Bible software that I use to study with. It's called Word Search Bible. And it started out as like a little software company in the north part of Austin. And before I was even typing on a computer, before I even ever used a computer, in the early days when I was dating my wife, she got a job working at this Bible software company. I didn't even use computers then. And one of the things that I started to understand as I was a youth pastor at the time was I was collecting books, and they were really burdensome to carry around and take them home from the office. I didn't have bookshelves, and it was just like carrying around this huge amount of stuff. And of course, then the Lord called me to pastor in Killeen. By then I started using computers, and then it dawned on me, really, as we were coming out here in 2003, that because my wife had worked there, she had had this enormous library that was given to her as a complimentary of being a part of the company that I would never have been able to have afforded had I just gone and bought the software myself. And I look at that and I go, this was God's provision. Of course, God knew that I was going to become sort of a computer person and I would be more tech savvy later in my life. And I look at that and I see all the ways that it's helped me, that it's helped me to be a better teacher, a little more informed, to be able to be more mobile and carrying my stuff from place to place. I look at that and I go, God knew long in advance. I'm very thankful for my software, because if you saw how heavy it is with just a certain stack of books, you would understand why I value so much having it on my tiny little laptop. Another example that I think all of us probably have thought of throughout our church being here is the guy that owns this whole property, Bill Shelton. Now, you got to understand, from my vantage point as a senior pastor, I've known so many pastors who've rented from people and they've done them wrong and they've been in places where the rent goes up so much they have to move or they lose their facility. And I've just heard so many bad stories over the years. And then I think about this man who owns this property, who was retired from the military, who, when we got into one of these buildings, has just continued to be of help and a blessing and has helped the church over this time. I go, you know, the Lord knew that this is the spot we needed to be. With the guy who would, you know, really just be an encouragement to us, who would pray for us. I mean, how many churches can say, yeah, the guy that is the landlord, he contributes to the church's income, even though he doesn't go there, and yet we pay him rent, and yet he helps us in all these different ways. And I look at that and I see God orchestrating us being here, and I go, wow, thanks, Lord. And the more that I see these orchestrations, these ways that God works, it makes me realize that I don't have to have it all figured out. God has it figured out. I would challenge you in your own life to actually go and think about the ways that God has orchestrated something in the past to prepare you for the present. Write them down. Try to think about all the ways that that's been a blessing, and we get a glimpse at this awesome God who has this timeless perspective. But lastly, Isaiah again reminds us of God's powerful purpose. In verses 11 through 13, notice what it says, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man who executes my counsel from a far country. Indeed, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, and I also will do it. Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted, who are far off from righteousness. I bring my righteousness near, and it shall not be far off. My salvation shall not linger, and I will place salvation in Zion, for Israel, my glory. Verse 11 here at the beginning, calling a bird of prey from the east, is another reference to King Cyrus. We learned last week was predicted hundreds of years before his name, what he would do. Cyrus would swoop down with great speed and accuracy, like an eagle from the sky, picking up its prey. Was going to happen. God was going to accomplish his powerful purpose because he has a timeless perspective and the ability to do what he wants. Notice he says, my salvation shall not linger. You know, this is really an encouragement, as God says this, for us as his people to remember that his timing is always precise and it's always wise. Some put it this way, pretty simple. God's never late. He's always on time. He speaks to the stubborn-hearted here, which really is a reference to the Babylonians, who were these rebels. They would be defeated by the Persian Empire. These unrighteous Babylonians would be conquered by Cyrus, and God would accomplish his purpose, having raised up the Babylonians to take the people captive, but then taking the Babylonians out with King Cyrus and returning into the land just like he said he would. God's powerful purpose was that this would result in salvation for Israel, that he would bring this king that would help restore the people to their place, out of exile, back to Jerusalem. That again, Israel would display its glory, its splendor. But see, God's people were challenged here to remember that God is worthy of praise because he knows the future, he prepares the way, he carries us, he holds history in his hand, he sees everything. And yet this great God with this great perspective beyond our imagining wants to be up close and personal with each and every one of us. I don't know about you, but that's just amazing. Listen and remember is the challenge here this morning. And I want to read you guys something that R. Kent Hughes wrote, Bible commentator. And I want you to try to listen carefully to this because it's a little bit long, but I felt like it was something very important to read. R. Kent Hughes said this about this particular passage of Scripture. He said, God is inviting us to trust him so freely and esteem him so highly and prize him so richly that we turn to him alone and enter into the salvation for which we're all looking for. God has hidden everything delightful in Jesus. Everything outside of that destroys us. And then he talks about this hymn, which I'm not familiar with a lot of hymns, but he talks about this hymn that's called In the Cross of Christ I Glory. Towering over the wrecks of time is kind of the phrase that's in that hymn. And he asks this question. He says, where is Marxism today? It's one of the wrecks of time. An old, defunct idol that some people want to pick up today, as crazy as it sounds. Where is secular humanism, he says? Where is utopian socialism today? Have you listened carefully, he says, to John Lennon's song, Imagine? He says, who can believe that anymore? The omni-explanatory claims that once compelled the attention of the world are looking more and more dated, more tired, dusty, in our post-everything age. There is a growing weariness, he says, with all grand ideologies that are out there. The idols are bowing down and stooping like Bel and Nebo so long ago. Why do we see these repeated patterns of man-centered hopes that are pursued with so much passion, but only accelerate pain and misery and suffering? You know, the prophets knew. God gave them understanding. God told us, and they knew that our salvation is not anywhere in the creation. It's only in the one who is the creator, the maker of everything. But see, that's what we find in our culture today is people looking to things in this life. And we're supposed to be looking to the Lord. God is there wanting to reveal himself, making sure that the cross of Christ towers over the wrecks of time. Because let me just say, there's all these ideas of man that are going to come and go, fall, rise and fall, but the cross will still be there. God will still be there. Seeing God's hand in the past should encourage us to seek his face today and to know that he has everything figured out. And how important it is to listen and remember these things within the crisis we find ourselves today as a nation, as a state, as a city. God already knew this was going to happen. He has it all figured out. He has a purpose. He has a plan. And so, yes, we want this to end quickly, but we need to also be praying, Lord, accomplish what it is you're wanting to accomplish. Show me what it is I need to learn right now in this place